So it's a pleasure today to introduce Mario Smilea from UC, I mean, from UC Berkeley as our speaker today. So as I mentioned, Mario is a BCCP fellow at Berkeley. He got his PhD from UC Davis working with Lloyd Knox. And then he was a postdoc at the Lagrange Institute in Paris before moving to Berkeley a few years ago. Marius's work mostly relates to the CMB. He's very well known for his really clear and insightful papers that explain interesting effects. You know, so for example, things like the phase shift from neutrinos, you know, for example. And so in general, you know, so if you want to understand some topic, I always recommend taking a look at his papers. Recently, he's been interested in CMB lensing. And so today, Marius will be telling us about a 2020s vision of CMB lensing. And so Marius, please take it away whenever you're ready.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for the very kind words. So I will talk about Sorry, I know this isn't a real presentation, but I'm still using a clicker, which is not working. I'll do my keyboard. There we go. So today I want to tell you about basically, you know, what my vision is for what CMB lensing will look like in the 2020s. And so I'm going to start with kind of a CMB polarization and lensing primer, and maybe this will live up to my clear and insightful explanations. And then I want to get into, then I'll describe basically ways that we come up with point estimates of the CMB lensing potential. Of the maps themselves, things like the quadratic estimate, machine learning based estimates. And then I'll move on to how we actually estimate parameters from the CMB lensing, which is actually in a lot of ways a harder problem than coming up with the single estimate of the map. And in there, I'll tell you about results from the South Pole Telescope quite recently that we've done. And finally, I'll get into not just estimating, you know, single parameters, but actually estimating full sets of band powers from optimal lensing and delensing. And, you know, depending on time, I have a few things at the end, sort of cool things that we're planning on doing in the future. So to start, just to get everyone sort of get the CMB lensing juices flowing in everybody's brains, you know, here's an image of the CMB temperature. It's about 10 degrees across. And I'm going to lens it by this deflection field. And, you know, this deflection field turns out under the so-called Born approximation can be written as the gradient of a scalar potential, phi, the lensing potential. And, you know, this you can calculate by just integrating up the matter fluctuations from last scattering all the way up to today. And so here's this temperature again. And now I'm going to deflect it by that gradient. And, you know, so this is the familiar lensing effect. It's very small. The deflections are a few arc minutes, but they're coherent across a few degrees. And here's the difference between those two images on the same exact color scale and on a blown up color scale. So you can see that the stuff that, you know, the power that gets added changed by lensing, you know, it's the pattern that you see here. It's kind of highly non-Gaussian. That's a theme of this talk. And this is what it looks like for temperature. So what about for polarization? So here's the same image, a simulated patch of polarization. You know, now this is a spin two field. It's a headless vector field. And lensing works exactly the same. Basically, you're just looking at this at a displaced position. And what's unique about polarization, though, is that you can decompose it into two different components, so-called E modes and B modes. And these are patterns on the sky that you see here. And they're defined basically by how they behave when you mirror them. So the E modes stay exactly the same, but the B modes, all the little bars, rotate by 90 degrees when you mirror them. So let me ask then, what happens when you lens, say, an E mode? So here's an image of an E mode, and it's been lensed, say, distorted. Here, I just sheared it. And there we go. Well, my animation is not quite working right. But here's right. So I've sheared it, and now I'm mirroring it. And you can see that, you know, what used to be a pure E-mode that looked exactly the same when you mirror it, you know, now changes as you mirror it. And so it's no longer a pure E-mode. It's not a pure B-mode either because the rotation isn't a full 90 degrees. So basically lensing mixes E and B modes. So now back to this image of the polarization field, and I've decomposed it. On the left are just E modes, and then on the right are just B modes. And you can see there's almost no B modes. There's a little bit, and that's the part I've put in a level of primordial, the contribution from primordial gravitational waves that's consistent with upper bounds. And basically, you know, the B modes we think originally can only be created from these primordial gravitational waves during inflation, you know, if they're there at all. But in any case, the signal is very small compared to the scalar E modes. And now I'm going to do the lensing again. And you can see, you know, the left looks kind of the same, but on the right, what you see is just this generation of a huge amount of B modes, just because of that leakage from this huge E component into what was almost nothing there before. And, you know, usually we don't plot these headless vector fields because it just kind of gets messy. If we plot the local intensity of the E and B that you see here. And so this is to say, you know, around hot and cold spots in E, you have the pluses and the circles, and around hot and cold spots in B, you have sort of right going swirly patterns or left going swirly patterns, and you can sort of see that on the right panel there. And if you look at it this way as well, you can see that the, you know, the B modes, and at least to my eye, maybe if you're not looking at these all the time, it doesn't quite look this way, but the right-hand side is really clearly non-Gaussian. Like the left is quite Gaussian, there's an equal number of hot and cold spots. But the pattern of B modes that get generated are highly non-Gaussian, and it's using this non-Gaussianity is how we search for them, and we back out what the lensing effect was, and then eventually clean it. So a little more quantitatively, you know, here's power spectra of those images that we were just looking at. You can see the temperature, you know, and the E mode polarization has been measured quite well. There's still some room for improvement, you know, especially in E modes and at smaller scales. And the B modes were sort of just now starting to measure really well. And, you know, these are key for measuring the lensing because, you know, that's such a clean channel. There's almost nothing there except for lensing, and it's super non-Gaussian that lets you reconstruct it. And so this is going to be improving a lot over the coming years, you know, one of the goals, which actually in this talk I won't sort of specifically talk about too much is to clean out these E modes and get at this primordial signal that sits below them, you know, which may potentially be there. And then on the right, you see measurements of the lensing potential itself, its power spectrum from various experiments. This is one of the main goals of almost every CMB experiment. You know, these are rapidly improving, and there's a lot of physics that you can extract from that power spectrum, having to do with, you know, the distribution of matter in the universe, the expansion rate, the expansion history, the geometry of the universe. So this is a really important cosmological observable. So how do we, you know, how have we actually estimated this lensing effect? So like I said in the intro, you know, basically it's about searching for non-Gaussianity. So first let me ask, you know, what is a Gaussian random field? And basically a Gaussian random field is this thing that has this property that if you take its Fourier transform, and then you ask what's the expectation value of the product of two modes, maybe that diff, you know, they could be the same or they could differ. And what's the expectation value averaged over a bunch of realizations? You know, if they're different L modes, then you should get zero if it's a Gaussian random field. And if they're the exact same L mode, then you'll get something, and that's its power spectrum. Now, for non-Gaussian fields like lensed fields, it turns out that even if they differ by a big L, you get something. And it turns out to be just proportional to the Fourier transform of the lensing potential at that big L. And because there's a lot of different pairs of these modes just in a single realization that differ by the same big L, you can average over a bunch of these just products of your data, you know, Fourier transformed at things that differ by this big L, and build up an estimate of the lensing potential. And that's basically the quadratic estimate. And it's sort of just been the workhorse of CMB lensing for the last 10, 15, you know, 20 years that we've been doing this. So it's this product over two factors of the data. if you want to get the power spectrum of the lensing potential, you just take the power spectrum of that thing. And that ends up being related to the true theory spectrum up to some normalization and bias terms that you generally calculate sort of semi-analytically or with simulations to correct for small residual effects. You know, and this works really well, but it is technically a suboptimal estimator because it misses some of the information. So in particular, the top equation there is only proportional to phi to first order. There's higher order terms there that we sort of calibrate out with Monte Carlo. You know, and also just very explicitly, it only used the 2-point function of the data. It didn't use any of the higher point functions of the data. And as we get to lower and lower noise levels, that information actually becomes important. So if you look at, here's a plot from a paper, which is almost 20 years ago now. And so this is showing you here, you have the spectrum of the lensing. And then these are noise curves. This first curve is the noise curve for the quadratic estimate. And you know, it's at some level here. And you can see that actually you can go even, you know, several factors lower than this. There's a log plot, right? So this is actually a big difference. By doing this thing called iterating the quadratic estimate, which basically is sort of means doing the estimate, delensing your data, doing the estimate again. More precisely, I think it's related to one of the Bayesian methods that I'll tell you a little bit later, specifically the marginal maximum a posteriori estimate. But anyway, you can see you can really go a lot lower noise levels than the quadratic estimate. And also there's a curve on this paper, which is the Fisher information. So one of the points from this paper was that actually, you know, you don't even reach the Fisher information. I actually suspect this curve might just be wrong. It's a great paper, but I think this is like a slightly forgotten aspect of it. I'll show you a plot later in this talk that is the reason I think this curve might just be mistaken. But anyway, you know, this paper and others, these are essentially forecasts or sort of highly simplified analyses. And, you know, now as the data is actually rolling in 20 years later, almost we're asking, you know, how do you do this to real data?
So Mario, there's a question there.
Yeah.
What aspect of the iterative quadratic estimator simulation here would you consider simplistic that might not apply to real data?
Yes. So the thing that this paper does is, so first of all, there's no masking whatsoever, which is actually a really difficult thing to take into account in practice, especially in some sort of kind of iterative procedure. And the second thing in the details of what this, you know, this particular paper does, It uses some first order estimates of the lensing in computing this. Essentially, you know, it's essentially a maximum a posteriori estimate with first order lensing only. And you know, in reality, you'd want to go to higher orders. But basically, I mean, if you just took what this paper says and tried to do it on data, on real data with masking and everything, it just wouldn't work.
Okay, thanks.
But certainly things related to it could work. So let's, you know, how do we get to more optimal constraints, you know, with real data? So there's several papers now that I've tried to use machine learning, which I think are quite interesting, that get close to that iterative forecast. The challenge is, I think, though, is actually extracting parameters from this. I'll go into this the next slide. People have just written down smarter, you know, just better analytic estimates, things like this gradient inversion estimator, which is simple, but it's only optimal in certain limits, useful limits, but it won't work everywhere. There's tweaks on the quadratic estimator procedure that people have done. And you know, these are important in the short term and for temperature, although ultimately it's still only using the 2-point function of the data, so it can't ever quite be the best thing. And then there's Bayesian methods, which I'll talk about a bunch. But just to say a little bit about these machine learning methods. So this is from this paper, which is, I think, just a few weeks old now, maybe even last week. But you know, the idea is, in some sense, quite simple, right? Train a neural network to map input data to output estimates of the lensing potential and of the delensed E modes. This paper actually also does the patchy reionization signal, but I won't talk about that here. That's the tau part. And using really, to me, what's impressive is the fairly simple standard machine learning architectures that you use, and it just works, and it seems to work fairly well. So here's an example from this paper reconstructing. You can see there the reconstructed E modes and kappa, which is just the Laplacian of the lensing potential. And you get something which is a small residual against the truth. But what you can see from this image is that, well, there's a mask involved here around the edges of the box, right? And then the reconstruction goes to zero outside the mask, just like a Wiener filter solution does. And indeed, the things you get out of this are sort of like Wiener filter solutions. They have power suppressed where signal to noise is low. So if you look at the power spectrum of one of these things, you see in the black dash, that's the theory spectrum. And then for different noise levels, you get a different power spectrum of your reconstruction. And so if you want to get something to compare to theory, you have to sort of debias this. And I think people think that this is really easy, but I would argue that it's actually quite difficult. And doing it without losing extra information is highly non-trivial because, for one, how do you know if it's a multiplicative bias or an additive bias? If you pick the wrong one, you'll still get something that's unbiased, but you might get more variance. And the second thing is, even if you do it correctly, the level of debiasing that you do might depend on the cosmology that you're trying to estimate in the first place. Like, for example, for the quadratic estimator, this is what the N1 bias does. And there we have sort of semi-analytic ways to deal with that. But how do you deal with that in one of these more complicated estimators? And sort of as a hand-wavy demonstration that it's not trivial, I just have this, which is just based on runtime. So this machine learning reconstruction that you see here takes about 0.2 seconds. One of the nice things about it is it's super fast. And it is, it's about 100 times faster than one of the Bayesian maximum a posteriori reconstructions I'll talk about. But even that's only 2 seconds, so it's not much worse. But if you look at going from that to full Bayesian parameter inference, which I'll also talk about, that takes you up to 4 hours. So that's actually where most of the work is spent, not computing one of these point estimates. And it has to do with, I think, how non-trivial it is to sort of at least conceptually think about like debiasing these things. So now I want to get to the Bayesian part of this talk. And this is something that I've been working on quite a lot over the last couple of years. And the way to approach this problem from a Bayesian perspective is super straightforward. It's write down a model for your data. In this case, I have a simple model here. Say my data is the lensed CMB field. So I use F here. I forget if I labeled it. F stands for either temperature or ENB mode polarization or something. I think of it as the CMB fields. So your data model is that you have the unlensed F, and then you multiply it by the lensing operator, which depends on the lensing potential, and then you add in some noise, and that's your data. And then you need priors on these quantities. So the unlensed CMB is a Gaussian random field with some covariance, CF. That can be controlled by some cosmological parameters, theta, or the theta could just be the theory spectra themselves. Phi, to a good approximation, although not exactly, is also a Gaussian random field with some covariance. So is the noise, you can say. And then you need a prior on the thetas, which could just be uniform or something. And once you have all of that, it's super straightforward to write down the full posterior joint over everything. And you see it here. This is really all it is, right? And this probability distribution function basically now captures all of the information that is in your data, including implicitly using all higher order moments of the data. So this is just moving that same equation to a new slide. And now if we want to infer constraints on cosmological parameters or the power spectrum, basically what we have to do is marginalize over so-called latent variables, which is in this case are the maps, the field and the lensing potential itself, and get to just the distribution function, the probability of just the theta. And by virtue of just Bayesian statistics, this P of theta is guaranteed to basically be the optimal answer and extract all the information that is there. The price we pay for this is that we have to do this integral. And this is integrating over the maps, which, you know, for even reasonably sized maps, these can be a million or more dimensional marginalization, which in practice, I'll show you in a second, we do with Hamiltonian Monte Carlo. But before that, there's another difficulty, which is that it just turns out that this this probability function is super sort of non-Gaussian and correlated. And it has to do with the fact that if you think about it, if your data says that there's a hot spot like right here on the sky, then that could mean it's a real hot spot there with no lensing, or it could mean it's a hot spot that was over here with some lensing that brought it to over here. So there's basically this degeneracy between the unlensed F and phi. And that ends up being represented here. And it makes sampling, you know, even with Hamiltonian Monte Carlo, quite difficult. And so a key thing that we do that makes this all possible is this reparameterization, where we do a change of variables and actually estimate the lensed field and phi, because then you don't have this degeneracy, because the data says there's a hot spot there, that means there's a hot spot there in the lensed field, period. And so you can see you do this change of variables, right? You just swap the variables. But the other thing is you pick up this determinant Jacobian term. And the determinant here is the determinant of lensing itself. So what is the determinant of lensing? You know, you're going to have to calculate that if you want to do this. And so that is where this thing that we came up with called lens flow comes in, which is a way to do lensing that gives you a determinant of one. So you can just ignore it. And here's kind of a conceptual idea of what this is doing. You know, consider this other way that people tend to do to compute lensing, which is to do a Taylor series expansion around the displacement gradient phi. So you have here the lensed field. This is just the unlensed field evaluated at this displaced position. Now do this Taylor expansion. And this is kind of like in a simple 2D picture. Imagine if what I'm trying to do is I start from this black dot here, and I want to compute an equation that just takes this dot and moves it around this circle. And so one way to do that is to write this parametric form, x of t and y of t, and say that's, you know, that's going to be cosine and sine to go around the circle. And then I Taylor expand the cosine and sine. And depending on how many Taylor terms I use, you can see what they do here on this plot, you know, so they slowly wrap to the circle. Although eventually they kind of go crazy, you know, to very high order, since that's what happens with the Taylor series. And in this case, if you stay exactly on the circle, that is the thing that basically corresponds to a determinant of one, because you haven't changed the volume, you know, the length of this vector. But another thing you can do, and the thing that's equivalent to what lens flow does, is you can write down an ordinary differential equation for x dot and y dot such that its solution is a circle. And that's what this ordinary differential equation here is. And then you can solve this with a varying number of ODE time steps. And you can see in this example, you know, you again, with more steps, you go onto the circle, but it's sort of in a much more smooth and controlled fashion. And you can get something which basically, you know, perfectly hugs the circle as long as you have enough time steps. And that's basically what lens flow does. So it writes down this differential equation, you know, instead of this Taylor expansion, it's this differential equation, which you solve to lens a map, and is essentially guaranteed to give you a determinant of one.
Okay, Marius, can I ask,
yes, please.
I think I'm a bit lost. So this Jacobian is a Jacobian of the mapping from the unlensed temperature to the lens temperature?
Exactly.
So why is it, so why are we setting the determinant to one? I mean, in general.
So you're,
right?
Say again?
In general, why would the mapping have a Jacobian whose determinant is one?
So, let's see. So, if I'm getting right, so I think you're on board with the fact that if you do this change of variables, you end up with this determinant L. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then your question is just like, why would that be one?
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
The question.
No. It's good. I actually think you may be getting at something which is super subtle, but and I thought about this for a very long time. And initially, I was coming at it from, you know, what is the determinant of sort of the lensing operation itself on a perfectly smooth, you know, infinite resolution manifold. It seems like there should be an answer for like, what is the determinant of lensing, you know, period, independent of how you calculate it. And I think that's actually not true, because as I learned, determinants of infinite dimensional spaces are these really tricky things that I never fully understood. But that's different than what we're talking about here. Here we're really explicitly talking about a lensing as a mapping from pixels to pixels, some finite number of pixels. And then we're saying for the algorithm that we use to do that mapping, you know, in the code, what is the determinant of that mapping? And so you can use different algorithms and get different answers, you know, and in particular, if for lensing you were to use the Taylor series, you would get something, which is not one. But the nice thing about lens flow is it just automatically gives you a linear operator that has determinant one, no matter what phi you stick in there. And it may seem kind of funny that both Taylor series lensing and lens flow should be approximating the same thing, you know, kind of real lensing. You know, how could one have a different determinant than the other? And it just has to do with, you know, sort of very subtle, small scale differences between what the maps that you get when you lens with either of these. And lens flow just does the thing that sort of fudges things in the right way to just always get determinant one. So hopefully that was somewhat helpful.
Can I actually follow up on that? Because I don't think I quite understand. So this determinant, why should it be one? I mean, it is what it is. Why do you get to choose the determinant?
Yeah, so that's really the subtle thing. Yeah, I mean, maybe other people can you know help me on this too. But the only place the determinant is what it is would be for sort of true infinite resolution lensing, where it's just perfectly uniquely defined, and determinants just basically don't have a, you know, there's all these complexities that I didn't know exist till I went into it about determinants on infinite dimensions.
So you're saying you somehow in a pixelized map you could somehow define lensing such that
exactly.
Okay.
So the determinant here is very specifically the determinant for, you know, how we actually do lensing on our particular pixelized map. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can imagine there would be different approximations to lensing on a pixelized map, you know, all of which are close to like real lensing, but you know, they can all differ a little bit, and similarly their determinants can all differ.
Thanks.
So let's see. Actually, I'm not seeing this animation. Are you guys seeing this animation, or are you seeing a big blob?
Yeah, I'm just seeing some little like music note.
Okay, let's see. I got my next slide has some animations. Oh no, actually this doesn't. I wonder if I on full screen if. If I click it, no. All right, let's see.
You can run it whenever, or if you have another application that runs animation, you can just run that.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if I actually have this. Well, this animation is not important. Actually, some later animations, I have files that I'm going to send you, paste you in the chat. So this was going to be a nice demonstration of Hamiltonian Monte Carlo. So, but all you get to do is look at this music note now. Anyway, you know, so with that reparametrization, with the posterior, you know, now we have this new posterior distribution, which is a function of the lensed field phi and whatever parameters we're estimating. In actuality, we do something even slightly more subtle than just the lensed field, but it's a detail. It's not that important. And you know, and then it's actually super simple. Just run Hamiltonian Monte Carlo. If you're not familiar with this, this is basically it's the cousin of the familiar MCMC, but that uses gradient information. You know, and you know that you would need gradient information because you're never going to be able to random walk around a million dimensional space and hope to end up in the right place. And it's really simple. I know I had this feeling, because I did this myself before I ever did HMC, but you know, it was like this I knew it existed, but it was this like kind of scary thing that I thought was hard. And once I did it, I realized it's so simple. And I always used to tell people like, you know, HMC isn't hard. It's like five lines of code. And then at some point I decided to put my money where my mouth is and actually try to write that code. And here it is. It ended up, 17 lines of Julia, but I was close. And it's really not bad. This is actually the exact code that we use in our lensing code. Most of it is spent, basically the way HMC works is that you picture being in this sort of potential bowl, and you take a little marble and you throw it at a random velocity and you let it roll around the bowl for a while, and then you stop it, and that's your new sample. And then you throw it again in a different direction and it rolls around the bowl, and then that's your new sample. And that's basically the algorithm, and you can see the code here. It uses the gradients to move along that bowl. And by virtue of that, it actually is efficient even in, essentially million or more dimensional parameter spaces. So I won't tell you, I'll basically now just show you the results, which will hopefully be convincing to you, that, sort of we can do this. This next part of the talk, I'll present to you results from recently, a couple months ago, where we did this to data from the South Pole Telescope.
Can I ask you another question? So that likelihood that you showed, it wasn't a Gaussian likelihood, but some parts of it was Gaussian. So I'm just wondering whether part of it is analytically.
This is very good. That's a very good question. So. Part of it is Gaussian, in particular, the part that depends on F. Mm-hmm. So the F part is Gaussian. The phi block is not Gaussian because there's sort of nonlinear dependence of the lensing on phi. And what that means, like you said, is that actually you can analytically marginalize out the F part. And it seems like that should help because, you should do everything analytic that you can and then only do the remaining part with these numerical methods. But when you do that, if you want it to sample, when you do that analytic marginalization, generally what happens is you combine the determinants of these Gaussians into more complicated determinants, which are now determinants of operators that are no longer diagonal. So that's, you did the analytic marginalization, you got rid of all these parameters in your argument, but you have a more complicated determinant. And so it's kind of a trade-off. And for sampling, it's kind of a bad trade-off because that more complicated determinant, you would have to calculate at every single step in your sample, and it doesn't work. It's actually simpler to work in this sort of most, least marginalized form here and sample this. And I think this is kind of standard for these hierarchical problems. And this is one of the big applications of HMC is the fact that you work on you sample the full latent space before you do any marginalization.
Okay. Thanks.
Good. So that, by the way, these questions are great, guys. Thank you. Keep asking them. So this analysis that we did here a couple of months ago, it uses 100 square degrees of polarization data from the South Pole Telescope. It's basically the deepest 100 square degree measurements that have ever been taken at the scales that are relevant for lensing. Obviously the SPT footprint is much bigger, but this was a particularly deep patch that was observed, which is suited for, trying these new methods on these noise levels where, I guess I haven't maybe made this point super clearly, but where you start to see any improvement over the quadratic estimate is exactly as these noise levels get really low in polarization and you start resolving the B modes with signal to noise greater than one. And here we're, getting close to that. So the one nice thing about this type of analysis is it's actually super straightforward to kind of put in a lot of instrumental complexity. I think people think sometimes that this is a challenge of these Bayesian methods, but it turned out to actually almost be a strength. You know, you just have to write down a forward model for your data, and then it's straightforward how to do all the rest. And this forward model can be, you know, fairly complex. This is what we used for this paper. You know, so here's the, there's the LF plus N, that part you saw before. Now, you know, but here we also have things like temperature to polarization, leakage, templates with parameters that are free and sampled, you know, beams, transfer functions. We have a polarization rotation calibration of the whole of the instrument, absolute polarization calibration. You know, we have masking, and you can stick these all in there and sort of do the sampling and it works fine. So basically we have that, we have the data, we run these chains and, you know, these, here's an example of samples from these chains that we run. So the samples, right, are, we sample the whole argument of that probability distribution. So that includes the parameters that we're interested in and also the entire maps themselves. In this case, it was about a 200,000 dimensional sampling problem. And here are plots of the main parameter that we were interested in estimating was the amplitude of the gravitational lensing potential, this A phi in particular between L of 100 and 2000. And you can see from the chain the values there. And then we also had these systematics parameters that I just mentioned were in there. And then you can also, the maps were sampled, right? So you can look at, you know, how did the amplitude of a given Fourier mode in each sample of that map, sort of what did it do throughout the chain? You know, several of, you know, not the full 200,000 you can see plotted here. So this part, I want to show you guys these movies, and I have this part, I'm slightly prepared. So I'm going to drop in the chat right now a couple of links to some movies, and then I'm going to pull them up on my own computer. And they will load. So you can make movies of, you know, the samples that you get from the chain. And here, for example, is a movie of the samples of kappa, so the Laplacian of the phi that we get. And this is probably, if you're clicked on the link, I bet it's coming through a little bit better. But you can sort of see that in the middle of the field where we had data, you know, some of the structures oscillate, but they're, you know, they're there. You know, near the edges of the field where there's no data, it just oscillates wildly. And, you know, this is, you know, it's kind of a sanity check to look at these movies. They're kind of pretty. There is real, you know, value to them because they essentially, these samples sort of describe all of the information that is there. If you wanted to take the, you know, to do some, take this as a data product and do some secondary analysis, this is what you would use to sort of describe the full posterior distribution given the SPT data. And you can do the same for the unlensed E.
Marius, at what scale does this end up being signal dominated? These roughly.
Let's see. Do I remember offhand? There's. I want to say a few hundred. And there's a plot in the paper that would tell you the answer to that, and I think it's a few hundred. Sorry if you wanted a more specific answer.
I was just wondering if you inter-filtered your animation then
it I have not. So I played around with a bunch how to filter these to make them look the best. And in the end, the one that looked the best was actually just the not Wiener filtered version, at least aesthetically. If you look at this, if you pull this up on your own computer, the images of this is the reconstruction of the unlensed E. So, you know, we sample the lensed field, like I said, but then in post-processing, you can compute any other quantity. So you can compute the unlensed E, and that's what you see here. And it's kind of cool to see the warping of this image corresponding to, you know, different possible delensings that the chain is sampling. And if on the kappa image it wasn't so visible, I also have this, which is a forecast for this exact same sized patch of sky, but with CMBS4 like noise levels. And you can really see how much better we'll be able to reconstruct this once we get down to these S4 noise levels. And this was actually taking one of the samples from the reconstruction and putting it in as the truth here. So it's, you can, that's why some of the structures look exactly the same. So let's go back here now. And right. So a little more quantitative now, some of these results, right? So the thing you do in the end is you sample, and then you bin up the samples into histograms of the parameters that you care about. Here are a set of one of these triangle plots where we're constraining the amplitude a phi, and then these systematics parameters p cal, psi pole the rotation, the t to p leakage templates. And this is actually a really cool thing that constraining these systematics are just like a completely unequal footing with all other parts of the analysis. Sometimes the way you incorporate systematic uncertainty is you just have the main analysis and then you sort of do little tweaks on top of that and just see how much the answer changes. And that's at least what's been done in previous SPT analyses. Whereas here, this is just totally straightforward, just fully jointly estimate everything at once. It's subtle, but it really means, right, that you're literally doing this optimal delensing at the exact same time as, figuring out what the right calibration is. And if there's some impact of that on how the delensing works, that is captured in this chain. And you don't see much degeneracy here, so there's not a huge impact. But one thing that did happen, is that at least in the way that previous SPT analyses did this, specifically the polarization calibration, how it computed the impact of, essentially how it computed the quadratic estimate in light of this uncertain calibration was not the best thing you could do. And you could improve that in various somewhat complicated ways. But in these previous analyses, the polarization calibration uncertainty was almost half of a sigma in terms of the final A phi. And here in this Bayesian analysis of nearly the same data, there's no correlation. So there's almost no extra systematic uncertainty from this pCal. And that is just because, the chain just kind of implicitly did for you the thing you would have had to work hard to do in the quadratic estimator case, which I think is quite cool. So one of the main things we wanted to check from this paper, let's see if we can see this do a little bit better than the quadratic estimate. And this is super modest because this is, we're just getting to these noise levels where you can really see this. But we did see it a little bit. So the green curve here is the constraint on A phi from the quadratic estimate. The blue curve is just the raw constraint from running the chain. It's about 26% tighter. And it turns out you can isolate some of the information. Basically, the quadratic estimate explicitly doesn't use the power spectrum of the data. It only uses it's the two-point function, but never the on-diagonal part, just sort of the different mode part. And you can remove that from the Bayesian case by marginalizing over this so-called AL parameter. And then you get the orange, which was perhaps the most fair thing to compare in this comparison. And you still see a little bit of an improvement. And these shifts here are basically consistent with what you'd expect, given the tightening of these error bars. So that's all in line. This is the first time anyone has ever estimated parameters from one of these optimal lensing reconstructions, which I think is quite cool. And another really cool thing you can do, again, sort of just for free, you can also get parameters from the optimal lensing reconstruction that happens implicitly in that chain, and also from essentially delensed E modes. So here what we've done is put in this other parameter, delta AL, which controls the amplitude of, it's related to the usual A lens parameter, which is to say that if you can just add extra peak smoothing. So not real lensing, but but a fake lensing-like power spectrum that just smooths the peaks. And then you can see, you know, how much does the data prefer real lensing versus that. And that's what this delta AL parameter constrains. You can just stick that in, modify that posterior, run chains and get constraints. You know, and it works, and you get constraints that look something like this. You automatically get the correlation between these things. And when I look at the, you know, there's really good works that have been looking at, you know, how to do this in a more frequentist way, and that involves calculating these super complicated covariances between the reconstruction, you know, the delensed band powers, and all these 4 and 6 and 8 and higher order point moments. It's just very complex compared to here. It's just sort of quite simple. So this to me, I think is definitely a strength of this approach. So that does it for that Bayesian parameter part. And now let me move on to, actually I'm happy to take questions whenever, but I'll stop in 10 minutes, no matter where we're at. But now I want to tell you about this work that's kind of in prep, on improving even a bit that previous procedure. And this goes under the name of what we're calling right now is the maximum posterior mass MPM method. It's kind of supposed to be related like MAP, like maximum a posteriori. So this doesn't maximize the posterior, it maximizes the posterior weighted by sort of a volume factor. So it's the maximum posterior mass, but basically this is the idea. So what we've been talking about so far, right? The idea was that you have this probability function. You have to marginalize out these latent variables, and that's how you get the constraints on the parameters that you really care about. And, you know, the integral that you, this super high dimensional integral in what I've described, you do via Hamiltonian Monte Carlo. This is a frame from that movie that you would have seen if it had worked. But there's another way to do this integral, and that is via the so-called Laplace approximation, which is basically just to say, go to the maximum of this distribution, and compute the Hessian matrix there, you know, and take that as the covariance of a Gaussian that you put at that spot. And that's the Laplace approximation, you know, and in this crazy banana shaped image here, it sure looks like it's not going to work very well, but the real lensing posterior distribution, although it is non-Gaussian, it's sort of, it seems like it's just very slightly non-Gaussian over millions of parameters rather than like a few that are like actual crazy bananas. So this Laplace approximation actually works quite well. And so in practice, actually, we don't necessarily do Laplace to calculate this. What we do is we do the Laplace approximation to estimate a derivative of this probability with respect to the theta that we care about. And because this is now sort of a much simpler procedure, we're not doing this, you know, still somewhat costly HMC, we can actually set these theta to just be the band powers. So, you know, these are now 50 or 100 parameters, not just like a phi and like, you know, a single systematics parameter. This is just now a whole vector of the band powers at different Ls, or at least in different bins. And we can compute these gradients using the Laplace approximation, and then we sort of iterate this, iteratively maximize this probability function. And at the end, we get a sort of a maximum likelihood estimate of the theta. It's an approximate maximum likelihood estimate. Right, and the procedure is iterative, so that's what's shown in this plot here. So this is constraints on the CL55 power spectrum. Each color is a different band power, and then the different ones are just showing you the different iterations within, you know, the computation of this estimate. And you can see that sort of you start with an initial estimate of what one of these band powers is, and then you do a few more iterations, and eventually you sort of converge to the final answer. And this is really nice now because now the data product is, you know, this full set of band powers that's much more familiar to work with. And, you know, it's actually much faster to compute this than those chains. Of course, it's not useful. It's not really useful unless it's also optimal. And the cool thing is that it is, and we can check this. So once you have a set of band powers like this, you can fit, you can of course fit any model to it. And so let me fit, you know, just an overall amplitude like a phi, because I can also run chains with a phi. That's what I was telling you before. And it works. So that's what I've done here. So I compute a quadratic estimate and an MPM estimate. I get those band powers, I fit an a phi to it. And then here's a histogram of those a phis. And you can see the MPM is, you know, these are CMBS4 like noise levels. It's outperforming the quadratic estimate. And importantly, so from the ability to run those chains, we can actually compute the exact Fisher information. Because the Fisher information is just the, it's just the curvature of this log posterior at some theta. And this posterior we can get from a single chain, also likelihood, but flip it with a prior. But we can get this from just running a single chain, and then we can do this average value by running several different chains, and we can get this exact Fisher information. And this does seem to saturate it. And also, because this Fisher information is only additive, basically, if it saturates it for this combination of all band powers that is a phi, it should saturate it also for any individual band power. So this, I think, is...
Marius?
Yeah.
So quick question. So can you also HMC the band powers for direct comparison, or is that not?
You can. Yeah. No. This is a good you can, and I bet we'll try at some point, but we just haven't, because it's 100% possible, and I think we'll try, but it's just getting a little hairy and a little computationally costly, and you know, and. It seems silly, like you're already doing like 200,000 parameters. What's an extra 50 band powers? But in practice, it just kind of gets harder. It's nice to do the single parameters because you can really kind of tune the mass matrix for that single parameter and make it work well. If you do the full set of band powers, it just gets harder. By no means is it impossible. I bet we'll even try it. But for now, this seemed like the better approach.
Okay, thanks.
Anyway, this is sort of, and it basically, it seems to work, and you can do this on, you know, fairly large patches of sky. You know, here's 1500 square degrees from an SPT3G forecast, you know, and these are sort of the band powers, the CL55 band powers that you get. These are delensed E-mode band powers that you get. And it all seems to, you know, at the level that we're at now, it seems to make sense and work, and it's much faster. So for example, this estimate you see in front of you was about 1 watt hour on 4 GPUs, and you get the full band powers. By comparison, so this is 1500 square degrees, the SPT chains that I was showing you, which are about 100 square degrees, the HMC chains were about 4 hours. So it's 4 times longer and 10 times less sky. So I guess this is 40 times faster, say, which is, you know, it's quite nice. Anyway, so I had a couple of slides here showing you some cool things that we're sort of thinking of doing with extending this, but in because of time, let me just skip to the conclusion and say, you know, so through the 2020s, I think, you know, all lensing analyses will necessarily go beyond the QE, which will, you know, sort of become obsolete. You know, the last in temperature is the one regime where I think the QE is really going to carry us for, you know, a little bit longer. I think solutions that are at some level based on the Bayesian posterior, and that includes the sampling that I showed you, this MPM thing here at the end. To me seem like the most promising way forward. We've demonstrated a lot already. I wish other people would work on this. It seems like it's me and close collaborators that are doing this. But I think there's a lot of interesting problems that are left to be solved in these methods. And for any and all Bayesian lensing posterior, I invite you guys to check out our code, which I think is fairly mature and pretty nice, cmblensing.jl. It's basically Julia, GPUs, automatic differentiation, and lensing, and it can do a lot of cool stuff. So thank you guys for listening, and that's it. I'll let me know if there's time for questions. You guys will know this. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Marius. So let's all unmute to give him a round of applause. Okay, yeah, so we definitely have time for questions. So does anyone have any?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
My question was, you know that there was maybe call it an argument, right, between the Wandelt group that does HMC for logical structure and then the Seljuk group that finds the map. And there was the whole, at least from the papers, my understanding is that Ura's argument is that that the posterior isn't multimodal and that even if it were, probably with the HMC, you would get stuck somewhere. And also that the correlation lengths of the HMC are like order of thousands, right? So it becomes extremely hard. So my understanding was that Ura's point of view was that HMC was unnecessary for this problem. Do you have a comment on that?
This is glad you asked that. I'm in a funny situation because, as you mentioned, there's this argument, but my previous job was with Ben Wandelt in Paris and my current job is with Ura Seljuk in Berkeley, so I'm like at the middle of this. But so this is what I will say. So I think that for lensing, there's nothing in these HMC chains that we've seen that indicates there's actually multimodality. I don't think that's an issue here. We've run a lot of these chains and there's just, you don't ever see anything that would indicate there's like two separate minima somewhere in this parameter space that, And then in terms of obviously there's this group, the Ben Wandelt and collaborators that are doing basically the equivalent of this for, for 3D, for large scale structure. And, I will say that that seems really hard. The stuff they're doing is, they're bravely going at it anyway, but it does seem really hard. What I would highlight is that, I kind of feel like the lensing problem, which is just 2D, is like exactly the right sweet spot where it's actually, you can really do it with HMC and just get the exact answer. We're already doing it on, hundreds of square degrees. I think soon we'll do like SPT3G thousands, eventually we want to get to the full sky. But I just think it's a little bit different regime.
What is the correlation length, like the Monte Carlo correlation length between independent samples?
Yeah, so we get now something like order 100 or so.
So for lensing, I guess, it's the difference is right that in 3D you would have to do like 100 n-body simulations for each independent point. While in lensing, 100 times lensing is not really a problem, I guess. So the argument also was that with HMC it would be difficult to do the band powers, right? But and you say this is even true for lensing, the band, right?
That's right. I think part of that is, I alluded to it earlier in the talk where I said the reparameterization we do is, I said there was like a detailed tweak on it. I think that part of the answer to your question is that detailed tweak. But basically when you join the HMC a map and its power spectrum, you run into this thing called the funnel problem, which is that depending on what the current value of your band power is, your posterior distribution on the map changes a lot. So like it's kind of like this funnel. And then even though HMC, is using the gradient information, it's hard to sample that. And I think that's what is being pointed to when people say that sampling the band powers is hard. One thing we found is just another change of variables, similar to like changing the variables to use the lensed field, that really, really alleviates a lot of that. And we used it in the SPT paper. It's derived in our other lensing paper. And so with that, I think you sort of undo this funnel to something that's much more Gaussian, and it doesn't seem to be a problem. I think that's something that could be of general use for anything doing sampling with band powers and the maps.
Okay, it's a super cool analysis. I really like it, your stuff. Thank you very much.
Awesome, thank you. We need to get Wienernet in it though, because one of the computationally costliest parts is just Wiener filtering.
We should discuss offline. But I also see that you have something about machine learning models of the slides you did not consider. Is that about the primer?
Yeah.
that about the prior of the
kind of, yeah.
We are like Utkash and I are interested in that for the KSC. So maybe at some point, like in using machine learning for the for the pride.
The stuff we've done basically is, we want to stick a Gaussian dust model into the posterior and, why not use a machine learning model?
Utkash and I are working something similar for KSC, where you also need these small scale power spectra.
Yeah, okay. Very cool. Anyway, so I think that this fits into this framework quite well.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, any further questions?
Hey, Maris.
Hey, John.
A very nice talk. I have a little question about the two parameters, A5 and AL. Could you explain more about them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have a great figure to do this with, but let me at least go back to this slide. This was slightly more subtle than I thought when we first started to do it. The thing is that to do this Bayesian thing, you need a full self-consistent forward model. And the way this is often done, right, is you take the quadratic estimate, you get the power spectrum, you measure its amplitude, that's a phi. You take the power spectrum of the data, you measure the peak smoothing, the amplitude of the peak smoothing, that's AL. But that is not a self-consistent forward model, basically, because you haven't, related how these two things, interact with each other. So to do this analysis, we had to come up with sort of one single data model equation that we could write that includes both the A5 parameter and the AL parameter. And that's how we jointly estimate them. And the way to do that is that we basically have the A5 parameter scale the amplitude of the lensing potential, which actually causes real lensing. And then this delta AL parameter is basically adding extra power to the data with a power spectrum that looks like peak smoothing. And so now, there's now sort of two ways to get lensing-like power in the data. Either dial up the A5 parameter, which dials up real lensing, which induces non-Gaussianities and gives you peak smoothing, or dial the AL parameter, which just gives you peak smoothing.
Okay. I see.
And once you have that, you can do these joint constraints. And one thing I didn't say on this figure, right? But since there's these two ways to get peak smoothing, the total peak smoothing, sort of the total thing that people usually call a lens, would be the sum of these two things. And that's the parameter that's giving the colors. The samples are colored by this parameter here, that you see on the right. So this is the thing that sort of corresponds to, the total A lens that people usually talk about.
Okay, great.
In view of the time, let's stop here.